Telecast.
Hi, I'm Justin Crosby, and welcome to another Telecast. My guest this week is hugely experienced British film director, TV producer, media executive, and founder of September Films and Three Tables Productions, David Green. Welcome to Telecast, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. So, where do we start? We've got a lot to run through today in terms of your career. So why don't we start at the beginning? Because I think Yorkshire TV was maybe the first stop on this long and illustrious career. But tell me about how you got started in TV.
Yeah, so I was fascinated by television from formative years through my early teens. I always loved television drama, television documentaries. There was only BBC and ITV in those days, of course. And, you know, but I always wanted to become a television director. That was my passion. So after college, I got offered several things by BBC and ITV, but Yorkshire Television was what I really wanted more than anything. And the reason I got offered a few things, my last thing at college was I directed Colin Welland's first stage play. So that at the Edinburgh Festival, so that got me a lot of attention. And the best offer I got was to come into Yorkshire as a general trainee. Now, I knew they had a good drama department, a stellar documentary department. So it seemed to me the place to start. I thought, general trainee, I'll go straight in and be working on great shows. It didn't quite work out like that. Life never quite works out like that when you're young. And in fact, I ended up on a quiz show, writing questions and finding contestants. The writing questions thing was a lot of fun. The finding contestants, I had to travel all over Britain to do that. But they promised me a trainee directorship because they liked the work I was doing. And at 24, I was made a trainee director with ITV. And I got my ACTT card. And there were six of us who got those traineeships. There was no such thing as training. It didn't exist. It was a rather strange word, really. My training was that on Monday morning in April, whenever it was in the 70s, April 74, I actually was told to report to a new soap that was being made called Emmerdale. Emmerdale Farm, it was called in those days.
That's right.
So Monday morning I reported, and my producer, Peter Holmans, walked in. And he threw two scripts on my desk and he said, you're in the studio Thursday and Friday shooting these. And that was my training. I mean, it was a baptism of fire and I don't know how I got through it to this day, but I think I got a lot of help from a lot of very experienced people. And I went on to, at the age of 24, direct 60 episodes of Emmerdale, the very early episodes, some of the very early episodes, which was a fantastic experience. It got me into drama. And I thought, when I did these 60 episodes over 2 years, I then did a children's television series called Nobody's House. But I thought, here I am at the best documentary unit in Britain. While I'm here and while I'm young, I would see if I can transition across because I can always come back to drama. So they gave me a gig on a couple of documentaries. I did a documentary series on European communism with Robert Key. I did a series, a high-end American medical series with Austin Mitchell in America. I did films with Sir John Gielgud and Lord Mountbatten of Burma. And best of all, I landed as Alan Wicker's producer-director.
Alan Wicker. Was that on Wicker's World?
That was Wicker's World. I did 29 episodes of Wicker's World between the ages of 28 and 33, flew all around the world, shooting on 60mm film. And that was, for me, my training on film. Not so much Emmerdale, which was half studio, half video, and half film inserts. This was real film. So that was just a wonderful experience. And funnily enough, just as an aside, I'm actually one of the judges on The Wickers at the Sheffield Documentary Festival this year. He left a bequest for young first-time documentary directors to get money to make films, much harder now than it was when I started. So I'm very proud to be giving something back in that way, really. And that's actually very exciting. We've just did the judging the other day, and we go up to Edinburgh and do the final, to Sheffield to do the final thing in June. But anyway, Wicker led me on to, I worked with David Frost as well, and did a film about Elvis with him, which caught the attention of someone at the BBC who said to me, what do you want to do next? I said, I want to come back into drama. I haven't done any yet. So I got a gig on a thriller called Chinese Detective, and then a couple of very big period pieces, Eastland, which was a two network special, which was number one in the ratings, and then a four-part series called Wilfred and Eileen. So that got me back into drama and got me on the drama ladder. But I wanted to make movies, and so I then transitioned from I thought the way to do it, because it was hard in those days to make that transition, I thought the way to do it was to make commercials. So I made commercials for a couple of years, learned to shoot on 35 millimeter film, did 50 campaigns, including, you know, an award-winning campaign for Red Mountain, films with Peter Ustinov and all sorts of people, and got my first movie gig after my commercial stint, a film called Car Trouble, which led on to probably my best-known movie, which was Buster, with Phil Collins and Julie Walters, which became a mega hit all over the world, was one of the biggest British films of the 80s. That was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, well, it must have been. And that launched Phil Collins' career in the States, I would imagine. I mean, already known as a musician, but obviously less so of an actor. Was that his first acting role?
That was his first acting role in movies. He actually, the reason we wanted Bob Hoskins to play the role, but my wife at the time was actually watching television. She said, come in here. Here's Buster Edwards. And it was Phil Collins in an episode of Miami Vice with Don Johnson playing a Cockney white boy. And of course, there he was. There was our Buster. And it was much more original and unique bit of casting, of course, than the great Bob Hoskins. So it was Phil's first film, and he was fantastic. To this day, we got nominated for the Oscar for best song. And I think to this day, it's only one of four films in movie history that's had two number one hit records from it, Groovy Kind of Love and Two Hearts, which was nominated for the Oscar.
Wow.
So from there, I was offered several things in Hollywood. Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was running Disney at the time, said, come over. He said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to make good films out of good scripts, basically. I didn't really know what to say. I was kind of a bit tongue-tied. And he said, well, you know, we've got this action movie. I said, well, I've never done action. He said, yeah, but you're a director. You can ride a bike, drive a car. I was back to Emmerdale and the two scripts being thrown on my desk, basically. So they gave me a $22 million, which was a lot of money at that time, action adventure movie to direct called Firebirds with Nicolas Cage, Tommy Lee Jones and Sean Young.
And that was Wings of the Apache.
Outside the US. Yeah, I had 500 Apache helicopters in Texas to play with. The Pentagon was supplying all sorts of stuff. And it was as big a bomb as Buster was a hit. Having made this huge hit movie, I then went to Hollywood. It didn't do well at all.
Right.
It only took about $15 million at the box office, but it became a huge hit on video, which was, of course, that time was the way you kind of transition from...
Was that VHS or DVD?
It was VHS at that time.
Right.
So it was a huge hit on that, and also a huge television success. I mean, BBC, it played to 8 million viewers when it was on. So I think that led me to thinking... We had a couple of personal tragedies in LA, my wife and I, and so we thought it was time to come home, and Channel 4 had started. There was a chance to start a production company. And really, that's how September Films happened. I went back and started September Films thinking, wrongly, that I was going to make movies. I had this track record, and I thought I could then become a producer as well as a director. But actually, that didn't happen. I mean, because the first project I did was such a huge success, and I became the innovator and starter of factual entertainment on British television in 1993 with a series called Hollywood Women, which to this day has the biggest audience ever for a factual entertainment program, 12 million viewers and a 52% audience share.
Wow. And what was that? Tell us about Hollywood.
Hollywood Women was really part of my experience of living and working in Hollywood for 5 years with Jeffrey Katzenberg and Arnold Copelson and Keith Barrish, my producers. It was basically a series of interviews with top Hollywood women, actresses, actors, producers, who was breaking through the glass ceiling of being a woman. It was really hard in Hollywood in the 80s. And the 90s, they were beginning to break through. So it was a four-part series. And it was slightly tongue-in-cheek. It was factual entertainment. I always used to say that Wicker's World was the first factual entertainment program because Alan entertained while informing. And we tried to do the same. I think we entertained more than we informed with Hollywood Women, to be honest. So Hollywood Women took off. It spawned 10 Hollywood series, and September took off as a factual entertainment and factual documentary company. We did make some films, which was my original ambition. We made a film called Solomon and Gaynor, which was nominated for an Oscar. It was nominated for an Oscar because it was a Welsh language version, because S4C had put some money into it. And the Welsh language version got it nominated as Best Foreign Language Film. We made a film called House of America, which won several awards. I made my own film for September called Breathtaking, which was for Sky Pictures, a thriller. But the movies never really were the bedrock of the company. And a good job too, because I wouldn't have built it into major indie, which I did.
And so tell us about that experience then of building what I imagine was a transatlantic factual production company right from the beginning, because I guess you said that, you know, you wanted to make movies, but actually you found out that, you know, your experience and what you'd seen in Hollywood led to, you know, some of the programming.
Time the programming, and also my own background in documentaries in my Yorkshire days. So I had that. I was very lucky, and I'm very, very lucky, because I came of a generation where you could do both. You could do drama and you could do documentary, and I did. I don't think filmmakers, program makers, directors, producers can do that anymore.
It's quite rare.
Everyone is put into a box now. And I fight so hard to make sure that my producers and directors get the chance to do everything if they can. It's hard, very hard, because, you know, you're not only put into a box, but the box is tiny. I mean, it's not just one area of factual or one area of drama. It's, you've got to make hospital films for drama, or you've got to make documentaries about blue light, flashing blue lights for factual. So it's very, very small boxes, but it gave me the chance to do both, really.
And so tell us about the rise of September Films then.
So we started in 93 when I came back from working in Hollywood, and we made over 2,000 hours of primetime television. We were the biggest makers of primetime factual entertainment in the country at the time. We were overtaken as the years went by other giants like RDF, but we started it off, and I was proud that we started it off. We also did serious documentaries, pioneering documentaries. People don't remember that. They only remember the kind of loud and slightly brash films that we made. But we made films about true crime and a lot of it was American based. We had an office in America for all that time, from 92 all the way through to 2013, when I stepped aside from DCD Media, who bought September Films in 2007.
And so most of your projects were transatlantic in terms of their outlook, or would it always need to have a US potential buyer in place for you to make a project, or were you making domestic UK projects as well?
It's a very good question. I mean, I think looking back, most of our projects were fully funded by British broadcasters, particularly ITV, who we were a major supplier to, but also by the BBC and Channel 4. Later on, you know, the digital channels that came along. We very rarely used co-production monies until the later days in the mid-2000s, when you had to go and get Discovery to co-produce and the like. It was an evolutionary process rather than a revolutionary one, really.
Well, you've been through lots of different cycles in the TV industry, at the film business as well, but predominantly in the TV industry. And we're going to come back to that in a little while. But one of those has been about establishing franchises, which you did with Bridezillas. Tell us about the development of that.
So, you know, I always used to think of myself when I was younger as a serious program maker. But actually, the things I'm best known for are the slightly flippant things that I invented, like the Hollywood franchise and Bridezillas, which went to 10 seasons, actually, for WE TV. We made that directly for an American broadcaster. It was hugely successful. I claim that I established the word in the British language. Other people claim it too.
Success has many fathers, right?
And so Bridezillas was one of our big ones. We had another series called Billy the Exterminator, which was funded by A&E Television in America. So as the years went on, our American office was doing their own projects independently of the UK, as well as servicing the UK project. So it was a mixed bag. I was very lucky to have some terrific executives at September Films, who are all big names in the industry still. Sammy Norman, who went on to Keshet and is now consulting very brilliantly for people. Sally Miles, who started Passion Distribution and is now working as an executive producer. Elaine Day. Max Rumney, who is a big wheel at Pact now. Pamela Covey, who ran my American office. I had some fantastic creatives like Peter Davey, who's at BBC now doing all the charity shows, Sheldon Lazarus, Janine Waddell in the old days. So I was very lucky. I had terrific people around. You're only as good as the people who work for you. And in my case, I always used to think they worked with me.
And what was it like working with Ozzy Osbourne? So you had a show, Ozzy Osbourne Uncut, right?
Yeah, so I went to Dawn Airy, and where Channel 5 started, and said, you know, I'd like to make something for you. She said, yeah, you're perfect for us. You do popular television. We want to do a film about famous people. I said, oh, okay, that seems fairly broad. Can we do kind of profiles of famous people? And I said, I suppose we can. Yeah, we'll have a look at it. We ended up doing 26 half hours. The first one was with Michael Caine in South Beach, where he was opening a new restaurant, believe it or not. We also did one with Ozzy Osbourne, who people, when we said we wanted to do a film with Osbourne, they all said, who? He was not well known when we actually filmed him in, when was it now? Probably the late 90s, early 2000s. But we negotiated with his wife, Sharon Osbourne, and we had...
And what was that like? What was negotiating with Sharon Osbourne like?
Robust.
Yes, okay. Which I imagine Banerjee are finding now, because I think the Osbournes is coming back, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
In the near future.
Sally Miles was the person who actually did the negotiations, and you could hear them talking many miles away.
Right, excellent. I wish I'd been a fly on the wall in those conversations.
So the Ozzy Osbourne, of course, spawned this huge franchise for MTV, which we were not a part of.
Did that come off the back of that, do you think?
It did. Sharon used our film to get that made. She went around Hollywood quite openly, and she admitted it, showing our film to get her series made.
Yeah.
But you can't bottle a personality. You can't, no. You know.
What are you going to do? Yeah. So DCD Media bought September Films, and then a few years later, you decided to leave September behind. What did you do then?
Well, the DCD thing is just worth mentioning briefly, because I thought, oh, okay, I've got a 3-year service contract, which I'll honor. I'm very fastidious and very meticulous in everything I do. So I thought I'd do this well and make sure I leave behind me after 3 years. I ended up staying 6 years because they immediately made me creative director of the group of companies that they owned at the time. And I listed them somewhere. We had some big companies, Box TV, Dun & Dusted, September Films, of course, NBD Distribution, West Park Pictures, Matchline. I mean, a lot of companies. So I became creative director for the group. And then our CEO left and they said to me, look, would you become CEO? And I said, no, I don't want to become CEO of a publicly listed media company, a PLC. They said, well, just do it for 3 months. Of course, I ended up doing it for 3 years. It was okay. It was certainly an experience, but I then stepped down and became chairman of the group and eventually went to America and ran our September Films American office, which was where my passion was, because I was back in the creative world. And eventually I left in 2013.
Right. And you were living in Malibu, and your partner was Jane Seymour, right? That's
correct. Yeah, Jane and I had known each other since the 1980s when I tried to get her to do a drama for BBC, which she agreed to do. So we kind of knew each other. Tried to get her on an Alan Wicker show about Brits in Hollywood when she was the hottest thing in Hollywood. We couldn't get hold of her. We couldn't reach her at all. And then finally, I did interview her for Hollywood Women. So we got to know each other better then. And eventually, when my marriage broke up, we started dating, and we lived together for 10 years and I separated from her in August. We're still friends, and we have a project together still, a Beatles film that we're hoping to set up.
All right, tell us about that, a Beatles film. I mean, so I'm all over the Beatles. So
it's a fiction that Jane and I conceived about, based on an apocryphal story that John Lennon told about the drummer who just drummed for them for 10 days. Our story is that he claimed, it's based on what Lennon said, claimed that he actually was involved in the lyrics of 4 of the big songs, including Nowhere Man and one or two others, and disappears into an institution and comes out 40 years later announcing that he was a Beatle for 10 days.
Right, okay. And it's based on the true fact, because
there was
Ringo went missing, didn't he? Or he was ill or something, and they had a fill-in drummer.
They had a fill-in. And our fill-in guy, who's called Herbert Kunkel in the film, he actually is 18 at the time, drumming for a school, still at school, drumming for a local band. And George and Paul go to see him and they think he's fantastic and they need someone urgently. They go back to John and they say, oh, tell me about him, says John. And John said, well, he's great drummer. Not the best looking person on the planet. Oh, we can't have him. We're all pretty boys. We can't have him. I tell you what we do. If he's good, we'll have him, but we'll turn the drums back to the stage and it'll take the lights off him so no one will see him, just hear him. And that's our story. It's the story of Herbert Kunkel and him coming out with the true story 40 years later. And after the success of Danny Boyle's film, we feel we have a shot with it. So yeah. Jane and I are looking to cast that at the moment.
All right. Exciting. And what was it like then living in Malibu? Because that must have been a very Hollywood lifestyle for you, living in Malibu for a decade.
Yes, it was. It was very different to anything I'd known, really. I suppose if I'm brutally honest, and Jane's wonderful, and we're still good friends, and we had a wonderful 10 years together. I suppose I lost my identity a little bit as a program maker, as a filmmaker, which is what I'm most passionate about. I found that as the years went by, I became more and more Jane Seymour's partner, and that's part of the reason I think why I separated in the end. Although there were other personal reasons as well, it was a mutual decision. But I think. I found that quite, and I've heard that from other people in Hollywood, that when you're with a celebrity or a big name, you tend to get labeled as the other person, the other man.
The plus one.
The plus one. That's a very good way of putting it, Justin. Yeah, the other person. And so that was always an issue, but it was great living a red carpet lifestyle and, you know, going to all the parties and traveling all around the world with Jane. And I was very supportive. She's fantastically talented, never stops working, has a big series on Acorn at the moment called Harry Wilde, which is in its third season. She's the hardest working person I think I've ever met. And, you know, she's also a great philanthropist and does lots of good work. She's a businesswoman, has her own jewelry line. So, yeah, I can't speak more highly of her, really.
So bring us up to date then. I introduced you as the founder of Three Tables Productions. Tell us about Three Tables then. Is this just purely scripted that you're focusing on?
Yeah, everything I do now is just scripted dramas, long-running series, developing long-running series for the streamers. And this is nothing I've only started a couple of years ago, but I believe that there is an enormous demand and will continue to be enormous demand. And I know we'll go on to talk about the state of the industry, but I think there will continue to be an enormous demand for scripted drama series. I think the streamers have changed the game, have moved the goalposts. So I wanted to get in that, not just for commercial reasons, but of course you have to make a company sustainable, because I believe that's where a lot of the best work in television is being made and can be made in the years to come. So I set up Three Tables Productions. They came to me, actually. JD Wong and Himesh Kaur, who are the two senior creatives. JD is also the managing director. They came to me through a friend of mine, David Wong, who I have another project with. And they said, you know, would you be interested in becoming part of us and becoming our chairman? And I said, you bet I would. And it's been a wonderful experience. Just developing, doing nothing but developing a lot of high-end and lower-tier drama projects. And we have an enormous slate, which I'm very happy to tell you a little bit about.
Yeah, well, do. Yeah. Tell us what's on the slate. Are you in development at the moment?
Yes.
Or are you in production?
We're about to go into production this year with our first project. But we're in development with a lot of broadcasters, a lot of streamers, and a lot of books we've bought, a lot of writers we've been working with. We're very broadly spread. So, for example, the first thing that we hope will go this year is a project called Emma's Baby, which is a four-part thriller set between Liverpool and Dublin. And we've got Virgin Media and Screen Ireland involved in funding that. E1, who are now Lionsgate, are deficit funding it as a distributor. It leans into the maternal mental health world. It's about a mother who loses her child on the tube, which feeds into every mother's greatest fear, of course. It's a very powerful thriller. Everything is not as it seems as it unfolds. We've got Alan Whiting writing it from a book by Abby Taylor. So that's something we hope will go this year. In America, we have a project with Apple, which we're very excited about. They won't let us say much about it, sadly. But I can tell you that it's a co-production, something we're very keen on, co-productions. No one is big enough to do it all by themselves anymore. We have a co-production with Appian Way, which is Leonardo DiCaprio's company.
Yeah.
So that gives us a certain amount of leverage and clout in LA. We have a project with BBC Drama called Critical Incidents, which is adapting Lucy Whitehouse's novel and series of books. It's a female-led 6x60 crime series written by Naomi Gibley. And we have ITVX, we have an eco-thriller. Channel 4, we're doing a rom-com series, we're developing a rom-com series for. We're doing a series called, a family drama called Dragons, inspired by J.T. Wong, one of our two senior creatives, his family history in Port Talbot in Wales, and Simon Evans is directing that. We have a project with BuzzFeed Studios.
Right.
Which is based on, again, I can't tell you too much about it, but it's we're working with them to develop a major part, a piece of their IP. We're working with the Royal Opera House to do a period 6x60 period drama.
How many is that? There's about 8 or 9 projects you've got going on.
A few more to come. we've got, did I mention Plunder?
Nope.
Plunder is a heist, it's an 8x60 heist thriller with ZDF Studios backing. We've got a book called Robert Barron's Daughter, which Red Arrow are backing. So we're very broadly spread among a lot of broadcasters, some streamers, and I think it's a compliment, not to me, but to JT and Himesh, that we have managed to put so much into advanced development.
Well, absolutely, and particularly as the market is as it is right now, which is depressed. Many people say it's a broken market, or certainly the TV industry model that we've known for the last sort of 10 or 20 years is broken. I mentioned it earlier, you've been through a couple of different cycles, a couple of different turns of the wheel, if you like, when it comes to the TV industry and how that's changed with the way of consumer consumption of content. If you were to start an indie right now from afresh, how would you do it? I mean, you've talked about scripted drama for TV or drama series being your focus. But if you were somebody without all your contacts and are without all your experience, and if you were starting off fresh now, how would you approach it?
Well, what interests me about what's happening at the moment is I think there's a gap in the marketplace for feature-length documentaries, for a company that specializes in feature-length documentaries. I think it's a whole new area, a whole new growth area. It's come from nowhere. 10 years ago, you could not get a feature-length documentary funded for love nor money. And now everyone wants them, Netflix, Amazon, all the big streamers, all the big broadcasters. And there's a real hunger for really good projects that are based largely, unfortunately, are mostly on celebrity or sport. It's difficult some true crime as well, although true crime is difficult because they're very difficult to kind of substantiate those true crime stories. But there is an enormous hunger for it. I think Jane Root is rightly credited with starting the Mega Docs some years ago, probably in about 2007, 2008, around the time of the crash, I think. And she got in, she was brilliant with that. I mean, she became the person that really pushed Mega Docs into the worldwide consciousness. And I think I would like to take that one stage further and do a strictly limited but focused feature doc company if I was to be given the opportunity.
Right.
I'm not sure I have the time or the bandwidth, but I think there was room for someone there, and I hope someone else does a divide it, because there's not many companies specializing in just feature-length documentaries, it seems to me.
And you talk,
and it's, by the way, it's just, sorry to interrupt, but it's just high-end. We're talking about high-end, expensive projects. I mean, $1 million plus an hour. I mean, this is where the demand is.
So this is blue chip, factual, feature-length docs. You talking about with talent, major talent attached?
Yeah, often with major talent, with major, either about major talent themselves or with major talent sort of narrating. I think it's interesting because television, British television, in my experience, has always done very well with television stars. But I think feature film stars are now needed to hit a worldwide audience, I think, because they're known everywhere. So often with feature film people. And sports documentaries, of course. I mean, full well have been brilliant at doing that. So they've done both the personality thing and the sports thing. But I think there's a room for a specialist high-end feature-length documentary company.
And now it's time for Story of the Week, where my guests get to nominate their TV industry news story of the past 7 days that's caught their eye. David, what's your story of the week?
Well, my story of the week really comes from the fact that I'm very optimistic about the industry, and we need to be looking. 2023 was a bad year, 2024 not much better, but I'm optimistic. I mean, there are more people seeking content worldwide than ever before.
Give us reasons to be optimistic, though, David. I mean, that's the thing. There's so much that, as you say, there is so much negativity just because casters are not, there may be many more buyers out there, but they're not buying at the moment.
I think it's up to us, the producers, to actually get out there and find ways of selling, because I think people are consuming more content than ever before. There are surveys and there's research to show this, and people respond to, you know, creative ambition. They respond to innovation. There's more and more ways of watching things, different ways of delivery. And we as producers must be much more proactive in finding ways of feeding this huge need for content and not stick to the old tried and tested ways. And I think my story of the week comes from that, because I think, I mean, Andy Harris said, and I wrote down his quote, he said, last week, the UK is in danger of becoming a top-end service industry for Hollywood. And that's not really my story. My story really is Jane Tranter, because she quite rightly, and this is a way to increase the output in Britain, she quite rightly said that the government, she was sitting on a committee for culture, media and sport. She was talking to them and being grilled by them. And she said it's really unfair that in the recent budget, feature films up to 50 million, the hardest ones to actually finance, have gotten these fantastic tax breaks now. But TV drama, which is the lifeblood of British television and is known worldwide, is not getting the same tax breaks. And I think it's time that was looked at and dealt with. And I think she's absolutely right. And I think for me, that it's a story that kind of got lost. It was actually brought to my attention by Himesh Kaur, one of my two senior creatives at Three Tables. And he and J.T. Wong said, you know, this is a story that may be worth you talking about. And I'd like to talk about it, because Jane is absolutely right.
Yes.
Let's get the British government, whoever the government is, and it'll probably be a Labour government next, let's get them to think about TV drama in the way they're now thinking about feature film. That will help increase the productivity, the amount of businesses available, and would be a very positive thing for British television.
And what about the poor factual producers then? I mean, I've seen calls on LinkedIn across the industry for, you know, what about us? You know, we're getting left behind. What's your feeling on that?
I think that's a good point. And I think, you know, they think it's much harder for factual. They don't get the breaks. Although, interestingly enough, the initiative in the spring 24 budget for feature films under 15,000, the ones that are harder to film, of course, by definition, include feature-length documentaries. So they will get those breaks. But you're right, the more tier two and tier three things are not getting the tax breaks more. And I don't know what the answer to that is. I think factual entertainment as we knew it and formats may have peaked, whereas drama still has enormous potential. That doesn't mean factual is going to go anywhere, but I think it's probably peaked.
And when do you sit when it comes to the social media giants, really, that are becoming the most influential businesses on the planet and, you know, really swallowing up the media industry? I mean, the media industry is just a tiny speck to what, you know, these technology companies are valued at. How do you see the media industry surviving? Because, you know, the method of consumption has changed now in terms of younger people and where they're consuming content. They're not consuming it necessarily through Netflix and through the streamers. They want to access content through YouTube or any of the other social networks. I mean, how do you see the future for content on social media?
Well, I think it's constantly changing. I think there is room within the whole industry to encompass the two. Of course, the traditional channels and the digital channels are fighting an uphill battle against the power of the streamers. And I think the streamers, by the way, will consolidate. There'll be a lot of consolidation in the next few years. And that's not necessarily a good thing. It's more power in less hands. It's a bit like the old Hollywood studios, of course. But I do think there's room for everything. I really do think there's room to find ways of making programs for new forms of delivery, for people standing at a train station watching a quick story on my phone. I think there's ways of making content, and you've got to, I think people have got to think universally. How do you do that on a universal level? I think things are constantly changing. I don't think anything is beyond the bounds of clever, innovative producers. I really don't.
And now it's time for Hero of the Week, where David gets to nominate person that he's putting on a pedestal. David, who's your Hero of the Week?
Well, there's absolutely no doubt who is my Hero of the Week, and I hope everyone's Hero of the Week, and that's Kate Middleton, Princess of Wales. What a moving and disarming and totally honest statement she made the other day with grace and dignity when she's been under such fire by every element of the media. It's been disgraceful what's gone on, actually. The grace with which she talked about herself in terms of her family and her responsibilities and duty, not in terms of her ego, I think was exemplary. What a performance. What a story.
David, and now it's time for Get in the Bin. Who or what are you telling to get in the bin this week?
Well, unequivocally, leading on from my last choice of Kate Middleton, definitely get in the bin all the idiots, all the bots, all the people worldwide who stirred up this media storm, this frenzy of lies and untruths, ridiculous stories about touched up photographs and visits to farm shops with surrogates or whatever. I mean, it was just unbelievable. So they can all, as far as I'm concerned, get in the bin. I hope they've learned their lesson, because I think the serious side of it, Justin, is that there are shades of what happened to Princess Diana in everything that has gone on in the last few weeks. And her son, William, has now found it happening with his own wife and his own family. I feel sorry for him. Everyone can get in the bin who has actually created this vitriolic campaign against her.
Yes. All right. Well, the media conspiracists and anyone who's trying to profit from that can get in the bin. David, thank you so much for joining us this week. It's been fascinating to talk through all your storied career. I wish you all the very best at Three Tables, and we'll see you very soon.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, that's about it for this week's show. Telecast was recorded in London and produced by Spirit Studios. We'll be back with another show exploring the business of the TV industry next week. So don't forget to subscribe to Telecast on YouTube, and you can find the link in the episode description, or just search Telecast TV on YouTube and hit subscribe. Until then, stay safe.